are there.
It's a bunch of those balls.
Today is Tuesday, March 8, 2016. Good afternoon. Welcome back, and let the record show that the House Resources Committee was convened at 1:04 p.m. Present are Representative Josephson, Representative Olson, Representative Tarr, was it Representative Seaton, my fellow co-chair, Representative Tallarico, and myself, Representative Benny Nyok, and I think Representative Huck is still excused. Let the record reflect, we have called to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. Hello to Christian from House Records. Hello to Matt from LIO. Oh, I'm supposed to turn it off. We'll come back to the Department of Revenue's Tax Director, Ken Alper. Let's finish the section analysis. I believe we were on section 18. Welcome back, Mr. Alper. Please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and begin. And before you begin, we have Representative from Johnson with us. Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. Thanks for having us back to complete this portion of the presentation. As I recall, we left off several weeks ago and have gone several different places since then. In some ways, Mr. Chairman, a lot of the information I'll be covering today was in a broader PowerPoint that dug into the modeling and details of some of the more complicated provisions of this bill. So for many members, this might be something of a review, but I will go at, and take as many questions as are needed. Section 18 of the bill was the part that there's a lot of conversation from us, from Mr. Meyer. This is the concern where a producer who has an operating loss but is in production and enjoys a gross value reduction could use that gross value reduction to increase the size of a net operating loss credit. So the way that calculation works out, and we had slides, Mr. Meyer did something similar, we could lead to an operating loss credit of significantly higher than 35%, possibly in certain circumstances in excess of 100%. In general, we don't like to talk about specifics of companies, although when Mr. Foley from Kalis got up, he said in his testimony that this would impact his company. His company is the sort of company that one could imagine getting this sort of condition, the smaller producers that might be operating at a loss because of a low price environment, but because their oil is so-called new oil, that production would use the gross value reduction, which could be once again used to increase the size of an operating loss. The mechanical treatment, the way we handle the problem in the bill, the way that it's written, is this new language added to the end of the of Section 18, which is the description of the operating loss credit. It says, for purpose of a credit under this section, any reduction under, and that's the GVR, is added back to the calculation for the calendar year for the determination of a carried forward annual loss. In other words, the GVR is a benefit if it's about reducing your taxes, but if it's in a circumstance of an operating loss, the GVR effectively gets added back, and the tax is calculated as if the GVR did not exist. And that's the structure of Section 18 and the intent to resolve what we considered to be and what Mr. Meyer believed was an unanticipated consequence of how the GVR interfaces with an operating loss at low prices. If there aren't questions on Section 18, I'll move to
Representative Tallarico.
Ken, Mr. Alper, so how significant an impact do you think this is to...
Mr. Co-Chair, the producers who would benefit from this are generally the smaller producers with the smaller volumes. So it's not a $100 million line item, because there's not that much tax in play. But I use the example of a company that, let's say, had a $10 million operating loss that under normal circumstances might enjoy a $3.5 million operating loss credit. With the interplay of the value reduction, that could be turned into what's called a $30 million loss and an $11 million operating loss credit. So in that circumstance, it increases the size of a credit by $7 or $8 million. I could imagine two or three times that as the high end of the dollar value attached to this provision.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure thing.
Representative
Seaton.
Seaton, sorry.
Thank you.
I just had a brain, whatever it is.
I know how those go, unfortunately. thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would this be the case also with the 750 million barrel field that we were talking about and developing of that? Is that still, does the significance of this change at all?
Through the Chair, Representative Seaton, plausibly, yes, there could be a much larger number. What would have to happen is the large field that we're talking about would get developed and then be operated at a loss. And that would be an awkward circumstance, but it certainly could happen, especially in an individual year. If someone makes an investment that size, they're not going to be anticipating losses. But if they were, a 750, you know, that's 100,000 barrel a day, or roughly 35 million barrels a year, let's say. Those 35 million barrels, with a 20% or even a 30% gross value reduction, because it's possible that field would be a high royalty field, that could be a fairly substantial increase, and I might need to revise what I said to Representative Tallarico. This could be a larger number in the context that you're talking about, a big field that's operating at a loss. We'd have to redo the numbers a little bit.
Representative Carr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But on that same point, you know, if it's that sizable of a field, likely it was a multi-year buildup to get to production. So the idea that, you know, a single year isolated in that multi-year project would be that dramatically different. I guess we've seen that if we take the last few years, but could you speak to how they might adjust their activity to, you know, reflect what would be, it would have to be a scenario like we're experiencing right now, where it was a very rapid decline in price in a very short amount of time, and then the company still decided to go forward with that sizable development.
Through the Chair, Representative Tara, I think the more likely circumstance is that the price happens after the field is done and in production. So the investment was made, and then they're in production, and suddenly you get a major price collapse. You know, I did the quick analysis, roughly 100,000, 35 million barrels a year, $40 gross value. It was about 150, let's say $1.5 billion worth of oil, but $1.5 billion worth of gross value of oil out there. 20% of that is $300 million. So if you use that $300 million to increase the size of an operating loss, it could increase the operating loss credit by 35% of that, or by about another $105 million.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's your true upsize, given the scenario of a much larger field. And I hate doing math in my head and into a microphone. It sometimes doesn't work out, but it doesn't translate that well. And we can provide that calculation in writing for the committee afterwards.
Yeah.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And would you also provide that on the 16% royalty? So that'd be the 30% GVR, and what that effect would be.
Yes, and Mr. Chairman, what I'll provide is an analysis that in some ways parallels the slides that were in the earlier presentation that described the calculation in Section 18, only increasing the numbers and changing the assumptions regarding royalty rates and that sort of thing. We'll use the same format that's already been presented to the committee to show a couple of alternative calculations.
Member Jim Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on what Representative Tarr said, Point Thompson, as I recall, was constructed rapidly. In other words, it went from tundra to, a pretty fully developed field in a matter of 2 or 3 years, and it's entitled to the GVR. So would that be a situation that might be problematic?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, yes, in theory, the owners of Point Thompson, for the most part, have other business operations on the North Slope, so they have other production that, so any losses from Point Thompson would be offset potentially by profits from other parts of the field, and their other production is legacy production that doesn't enjoy the gross value reduction. So the amount of GVR they'd be receiving is relatively minor in the context of their overall production profile, which is different from the, to use Kalis as an example, because they did, well, all of their production is in the GVR category.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So Section 19 is the... it talks about the hardening of the floor, that the credits in 4023 can't reduce tax liability below the minimum tax. And primarily here we're talking about the operating loss credit, because elsewhere in the bill we're looking to repeal the capital credit and the well use expenditure credit. So what we're saying is that a carried forward net operating loss credit can't be used to reduce tax liability below the minimum tax. This is the circumstance that primarily would refer to a major producer, where if one of the companies who is not eligible to get cash for their operating loss credits were to carry that credit forward into a next year, if there were a second consecutive year of low prices, after 1 year there was a loss beginning in January of the second year, which we have right now, typically the companies would be paying 4% of their gross value as a monthly tax payment, and we are saying, but that could be offset by an operating loss credit. The change made by Section 19 would force that company to continue to carry their operating loss credit forward into some future month or some future year where the prices had sufficiently recovered to where they could use the credit to offset taxes but not go below the minimum tax. For as long as we stayed at the floor level, they would have to continue to carry that credit forward. The other change made in Section 19 is to put an expiration on certain operating loss credits that says if this were to happen and a company can't use up their credits within 10 years, they would actually be truly foregone, that the net operating loss credits would go away after 10 years if the company was not able to use them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just wondering if you can help me understand, on this particular provision, essentially the 10-year sunset, what would happen if during that period of time there were other changes made to the taxes that affected that company's operations? Would those just be sort of separated and they would just always, you know, be in the bank, so to speak, for them, regardless of other tax changes, whatever their tax liability was, that would be separate?
Through the Chair, Representative Todd, thank you for the question. I think it's important to kind of go back to this issue of what is a credit. And the idea of this word certificate that you often hear in testimony, that when a company earns a credit and applies for the credit and gets awarded the credit by the Department of Revenue, it shows up in the form of a credit certificate. That is an asset. That's a thing that they have physical possession of that they will use to either turn in for cash or use against their taxes. So the answer to your question is no, that subsequent changes wouldn't affect the existence of their certificate. They would be holding it, and until such time as they had a tax liability, under whatever circumstance, they would use it. The other option that any company has is to sell it. If they don't owe any taxes, but they know someone else who does, they should be able to sell that certificate and get generally less than 100 cents on the dollar, but be able to get value for their credit certificates.
Thank you.
So if I may, Mr. Chairman, moving on, Section 20 works with Section 19. It creates the statutory language to establish that there is a 10-year sunset on the existence of certain credits. It says...
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. I want to go back to 20. Let's say in year 9 years and 11, let's say 7. Does that give 1 month for the person who purchased it to cash it in, or do they have 10 years at that point to hang on to it?
Through the Chair, Representative Johnson, the 10 years is the lifespan of the certificate itself. So if, in fact, they sold it 9-plus years in, then the buyer would only have a limited period of time. Ideally, at that point, the person buying it is someone that has an active tax liability at that moment, of course.
Right. I just wanted to be clear that it's not can stack the certificate expirations, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mr. Representative Johnson, there's no... that the intent of the change is to have that flow with the life of the certificate itself.
Okay.
Moving to Section 21, the change in Section 40, which is the repealer section of the bill, deletes the qualified capital expenditure credit in 4355023A. Because of that change, we need a lot of conforming language where other parts of existing law refer to different sections in 023, especially A. So if you look at the actual bill, 21 of the bill, the section itself doesn't really matter. The section of the bill has to do with conditions under which credits can be transferred and all of that. But it refers to subject to limitations set out in A through D of this section, and we're changing it to B through D of this section simply because A is no longer going to exist. So we're creating a conforming change that reflects the fact that A is being repealed elsewhere in the bill. Section 22, meanwhile, is in fact new statute, and this is important, and this is language that we developed with the Department of Natural Resources. They might be on the line and have comments of their own on this specific section. But what happens is there is a requirement in our existing expiration credit statutes that certain data be provided to them as a condition of receiving those credits, and that data, it can generally be made public after 10 years. We're mostly talking about seismic data, but also some downhole wellbore type information. So DNR gets that information provided to them. One of their concerns with the impending sunset of the expiration credits, many of which are going away this July, regardless of the bill before you, is that they won't be able to get that data and make it public anymore. And they like having that data as a marketing strategy for Alaska's oil patch, that they could use it to say, look at all this great seismic data from 10 years ago. There's a lot of resource out there. Please come and buy leases in Alaska. So what we're saying is, as a condition of receiving the remaining credits that exist in law, the net operating loss credit primarily, we are requiring the recipient of that credit to provide their comparable geological data to the Department of Natural Resources, which could be then made public 10 years later.
Appreciate.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sometimes the thought has to gel a little bit. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the thought that, through the chair, Mr. Opper, that the owner of the data, if they didn't use it to some benefit within a decade, they might as well make it a transparent public piece of data?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I think that's part of it. I think in general, that the data was bought in part with the state resource, with credit money, and therefore the state gets something tangible in return for it, was part of the thinking. The sharing of the data with DNR for DNR's internal confidential purposes is part of general statute. That's not going anywhere. What's specific here is that data becomes public in 10 years that DNR can share it. I had a conversation with them just a day or so ago. I was concerned that this might lead to too much data, them requiring new computers or something to be able to deal with all that data. But what I learned was, for the most part, they're already getting the data. What we're changing is the terms and conditions under which it could be shared and made public.
Thank you.
Section 24, Mr. Chairman, is, and I spoke earlier, I believe it was in Section 19, about the so-called hardening of the floor. Those changes are made in various places in the bill because we're hardening the floor versus multiple credits. This change in Section 24 The change in Section 23 is the small producer credit in 4355024G. And the small producer credit is up to $12 million received by producers who make less than a certain amount of oil. Or gas. It's tied to the volume we produce, and it maxes out at $12 million. Those credits can currently be used on the North Slope to reduce tax liability below the minimum tax all the way down to zero. What the change in Section 23 would do was bring them under the 4% floor as well. So the small producers would be forced to pay at the 4% level and not be able to use that credit to go below. Similarly, Section 24 is another floor hardening provision that describes the $5 per barrel credit in 4355024I. That's the analog to the sliding scale credit. When you hear the term sliding scale credit, the 0 through 8, that's the legacy oil. That's the old fields that are paying the the minimum tax. That credit is currently hardened, so it can't go below the minimum tax. However, the so-called new oil that gets the $5 per barrel credit, they can use that to go below the minimum tax. The change in 24 would change that. But it would say, no, these new producers also have to pay at the minimum tax level, regardless of the price of oil. So you're seeing several of these. And likewise, Section 25, a nearly identical structure, this refers to the exploration credits to the extent that they still remain. Now, if they're in the North Slope, those also would not be able to be used to bring the tax payments below the minimum tax of 4% of the gross. So 23, 24, and 25 are identical. They're just specifically changing three different credits to say you can't use them to go below that 4% floor level.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On Section 24, it's not the department's position that this falls under the arguably inadvertent category. In other words, it was understood that the GVR, along with being this privilege, there would be yet another privilege attached to it where the tax could drop beneath the 4% floor. Is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, that was well understood by the committees in 2013?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Josephson, absolutely. I remember the hearings in this room, and the language evolved, but the final version that was in the House Resources Committee substitute, 43024I, which is the $5 credit, and J, which is when the sliding scale credit was introduced in House Resources, because it had also previously been a $5 credit. I very explicitly said cannot be used to go below zero, and Jay said cannot be used to go below the minimum tax calculation, the reference to 4355011 sub F, which is the minimum tax on North Slope oil. So this was very much intentional.
Proceed.
Okay. On a new page of the document. So we're now in Section 26. Section 26, it makes several changes that talk about limitations on being able to use credit certificates. This isn't about earning the credits. The credits are going to be earned. The work is going to be done. You're going to have these certificates that I referred to earlier in answering Representative Tarr's question. The follow-up here is, can you use them open-endedly to get cash for them? Currently, unless you have in that $50,000 or more category, the answer is yes. It's an open-ended ability. What Section 26 does is add several different limitations to that. Number one is sub 26E, E sub 2, to say, and this is a change that's made elsewhere in the bill as well. Formerly we said, if you owe taxes to the state, you can't get credits. If you can't get paid your credits, first you have to use the credits to pay your taxes, or we'll sort of pay them for you. We'll hold back the credit sufficient to pay a tax liability that you owe. We're intending to expand upon that in elsewhere in the bill to say if you owe other obligations to the state, and the examples I've previously given are a royalty or a lease payment to the Department of Natural Resources or a fine to the OGCC or some sort of or from the Department of Environmental Conservation, generally related to your operation. But if a company has an obligation to the state, we also want to be able to use a tax credit payment to pay that off. So the first part of Section 26 sub 2 conforms with that change. It says the applicant does not have an outstanding liability to the state, and then it deletes the word for unpaid delinquent taxes under this title, thus broadening it to all unpaid liabilities to the state. So the first part's small and conforming, but meaningful. The next two parts are more...
Before you go back a little further, Director Feige would like to comment on Section 22.
Yeah, that is just a bit more.
Jay, are you on, Mr. Feige?
That the vessel could operate here and that it's based in something that could actually operate in this theater, then I'm fine, but I'd rather hear that back from him before we just kind of say, yeah, we'll say it.
I don't know if she's on the line right now.
Speak to her. I don't know if she's online.
I can't.
We need to speak to her. I don't know if she's online.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
You need to speak to her and let her know she's online.
Oh, she's on nine?
Yeah.
Oh. So what just... She wants to...
I'll take it at ease.
Take it at ease, please. Director Feige, you're online. Can you start your comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do apologize. I tried to chime in a little earlier on Section 22. I just wanted to make a follow-up comment, if I could please, to what Director Alper offered regarding the addition of the data coming into DNR if and when the existing tax credit programs expire. We did do, as Director Alper indicated, a bit of in-house due diligence on that, and we determined that while it will not create additional extra volume of data for the department, one thing that we just want everyone to be aware of, as it will be material, and I'm sure we'll hear from industry on this, this would now be taking production data, development data, and making that data public as opposed to just the exploration data. So that is one key difference going forward. However, in terms of the volume of data, the division currently does receive all of the production data and development data. It is just not made public at this time. This language, however, would change that, and that data would now become public as well as any exploration data.
Any questions or comment? Thank you. Oh, Representative Seed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm understanding that this would become public 10 years later, but you're saying that it's not the same data, it's additional data, I'm just not for their current operations instead of being well or seismic exploration as on page 18, line 9.
Correct. Yes, Representative Seaton, through the chair. For clarity, right now the division receives exploration well and seismic data under the tax credit programs. By moving this language into the new legislation, when the tax credit programs expire, what this language will allow DNR to do is continue to receive the exploration seismic and well data, and that will continue to go public. What will be new is that any seismic data that is acquired within an existing producing unit, any production well data acquired within a producing unit, that too would now become public. Under current statute, the unit data that is collected is not exploration data. That's considered development or production data, and that information is currently held confidential, including the seismic data, into perpetuity. The division receives that data under the under other statute and under the lease requirements, lease and permit requirements.
Representative Seaton.
And follow up, I guess, to the administration that's here. Is that the intent of this section, to not just make it the seismic or well data that was the basis of the credits, but will be all future production data?
Well, through the chair, Representative Seaton, and I'm going to start answering that. I think I am going to call a lifeline and get Ms. Grammering from the Department of Law up here. My understanding of the intent was to replicate the data that they're currently receiving, that they would not be able to receive simply because those exploration credits are sunsetting. If, in fact, we've broadened the net, so to speak, into additional data, I was not personally aware of that, but I think I'd like to bring the representative of the Department of Law up here. It might help clarify that.
Just state your name for the record and proceed.
For the record, Mary Hunter Gramling, Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. And so if you look at page 18, line 4 of the bill, you'll see that it says a producer or explorer shall comply with the notice and information requirements in AS4355025, and then it says F2. F2 currently applies only to explorers seeking a credit under that section. This would move those requirements to explorers or producers seeking a net operating loss credit, in effect. So it would potentially broaden that. If I think the administration would be willing to work to narrow that if that's, you know, the intent of the committee.
Thank you. Representative John?
Yeah. So this is in an existing, Mr. Chair, this is in an existing unit, and we're getting additional information. I'm a little perplexed as why we would, we already own it, we just want to make it public. So I understand, unless you're trying to sell a unit out from under someone, why you'd need to make that public.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the data that they, and I don't, what DNR has previously received in exploration credits is not something that I'm personally terribly familiar with, so I think we might want to get Ms. Faye to talk a little bit more. But because, well, I think what Ms. Gramling just said is because we're moving the language from the exploration credit section, which is quite explicit to only being new areas at the fringes, and attaching the requirement to the data to the operating loss credit, we are, in effect, putting those requirements on anything that earns the operating loss credit, which would then include the stuff inside the units, for example. I don't know what the public purpose in making those things public in 10 years is. I think it might be an inadvertent byproduct of trying to make this change, of trying to protect DNR's interests of getting, of continuing to get the exploration data and the seismic data for their planning purposes. The expectation is those activities with the sunset of the exploration credit will still be seeking operating loss credits. So the hook to continue to get that data for those expenses has to be somehow attached to the operating loss credit. It's not the administration's desire to get that data from these other things. It sounds like it's an inadvertent byproduct of the way the bill is written.
For the record, Representative Heron has joined us.
So, and my concern about making it public part, and I understand that as long as we own it, as the state has it, I just don't understand what purpose it serves unless you're trying to, like I say, remarket the unit to someone else, sell the leases, resell the leases. So I've got real concerns about that and the kind of confidence that's going to instill in people trying to buy leases from us. So I'd certainly like to revisit that at some point, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and through the Chair, Representative Johnson. I agree with you that that's by no means our intent. A lot of the data that they get at DNR, seismic data is not necessarily shot between inside someone's unit boundaries. They've got a pretty excellent network of data that goes all over the North Slope. They use that to market the unleased areas of the state. Obviously, no one's in a position to lease something that's already leased, but if we have information that's inside somebody's line, it might help lure someone in to buy a lease on the other side of the line, that kind of thing.
You know, it's not that I'm paranoid, and I guess you're not paranoid if you're really out to get you, but we've now established a tremendous relationship with the industry, and if I'm a little paranoid, I can't imagine what they are. So I just, if nothing else, I want to state for the record that it's not the intention to do this as part of the public record, that it's not the intention to do this for some unforeseen, that it is more than likely an oversight in the drafting of this legislation.
Yes. Through the Chair, I agree with Representative Johnson. It is not. The intent of this section is to preserve the information that DNR currently gets from explorers and find a mechanism for them to obtain that data with the expectation of the exploration credits themselves for sunsetting. Anything beyond that is an inadvertent byproduct of the drafting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'm Representative Torr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just looking at this, the language in 247, it doesn't say shall, so it's the Department of Natural Resources may publish this information. And so I guess that leaves it up to the department, actually, to describe whether that information would be made public after the 10-year period. If I'm reading the other section of statute here correctly on the spot. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, that's my understanding, but I would like to hear from Director Feige to better answer that question. It's her department, and her, it's her mayor, Shaw.
And yes, Representative Tarr, through the chair, the department and the division up to this point have exercised the ability to make that exploration data public. There is always the consideration of is there you know, potential for commercial harm to, for example, if you have well data, and there is either unleased lake acreage on one side or adjacent to a block. The companies have been able to come in and request an extended period of confidentiality on exploration well data in order to preserve their commercial interests, and in many cases the division has granted those extensions. With seismic data, there is no ability to request the extended confidentiality of the seismic data acquired under the credit programs. However, what you typically see are very broad surveys run over very large regional areas. You also have brokers who could have, you know, much older vintages of data in areas, and those areas will often overlap. In the case of the seismic, I don't know of a situation where the data has been set aside and not considered for being made public, unless, of course, it is on private lands or some other aspect that will remove it from the, you know, the division's ability to make it public. And it should be noted as well that only now are we in the process of publishing and making available to the public the very first releases of seismic data under those credit programs. And so this will be data that was collected in 2004, 2005 that will now be being made public. So this is really the first rollout of that data.
And just a follow-up. So thank you, Director Feige. And so if I understand this, you know, this is, because the credits go away, still gives us a mechanism to get the information, but you will have the ability to control what information is released.
Yes, Representative Tarr, through the chair, that is correct. And we would have to work with the Division of Revenue, or the Department of Revenue, rather, in making sure that we could put together a list of projects that will have data that come available. Obviously, that becomes more problematic when we're talking about development data and the in-unit data because of the confidentiality associated with even claiming a tax credit. So as Director Alper mentioned a short period of time ago, we'd have to work together with them to make sure that we're only capturing that exploration data and meeting the intent of the data release as it's defined in the current exploration credit programs.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Feige, Andy Josephson here. So this is an entirely new section, but are you saying that right now DNR has some discretion, it writes the regs, and then it reaches sort of some sort of agreement with the producers? You said they can intervene and you work with them if they want an extension of confidentiality provisions. And is that sort of how you see this provision working as well? Is that what I hear you saying?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, actually no. At the present time, the division would receive a request from an explorer who, for example, would have drilled an exploration well. Only the exploration well data qualifies for an extension of the confidentiality period. And at present, well data is held confidential for a period of 2 years. Then the explorer, if they feel that there would be some, you know, potential commercial harm to them or some other factor that they need to bring to the attention of the division where they would be harmed by the release of that exploration well data, they can then, under statute, apply to the division to have an additional 24 months of confidentiality placed on that well data. And we do see that fairly routinely. A lot of the native corporations, for example, would like their well data on their lands held confidential. And so that's a fairly well-traveled path. Where exploration seismic data is concerned, that data cannot be extended under the credit programs. That data cannot be extended, and it is released at the end of the 10-year period.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. Can we request that the DNR and DOR submit a narrowed version of this so that we get it right? I mean, you know, I mean, I could try a hand at it, but I'm not the experts, and so I'd just like to request that the two agencies work together with law and come up with the narrow definition to just simply extend the current data and disclosures that we have.
Can you have that done?
Mr. Chairman, if you'd mind to look over my shoulder for a moment and check in with the attorney. Could I just have a moment, please?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it can be done. We need to confirm with the governor's office before we can propose amendments directly, but that's just the nature of the amendment process. But yes, it can be done technically, and we presume we'll be given the ability to do that, yes.
Okay. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess for both directors, I think what could be helpful about seeing this information is that as we think of this, you know, sort of idea of what do we get for the credits, this sort of changes the value in my mind, and so I'd like to understand better that piece of it, if when describing that you have anything to offer there, and perhaps Director Feige wants to comment on that. But this is certainly, you know, information that we can use for further development or leasing work, I would think, and so there's got to be some, you know, even if it's very generalized, monetary value that we could assign to that.
And yet, Representative Tarr, through the chair, if I understood your question correctly, yes, we have done, the division has done a back of the envelope estimation of what it would cost the state to go out and acquire the seismic data that up to this point has been received through the credit programs. And we can certainly provide you with that. It was a high level planning number just to give us a sense, and we presented that information during Senator Giesel's tax credit working group presentations over the course of the summer. And so we do have numbers calculated for that acquisition value for both the North Slope and Cook Inlet. And yes, we can absolutely provide that to you.
Can I ask the committee members to put in writing their request to both co-chairs, and then we can share that information to all of you? Thank you. Anything else? Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We were, before we went back to 22, we had been through 23, 4, and 5, which were all a part of this broader idea of hardening the floor. I'm talking about the various subsections of Section 26. Section 26 is the limitations on the state's purchasing credits. We are in the statute that's currently what's known as 028E. 028E is right now contains the you could see it in the bill if you have any members have the bill in front of them on page 19, line 15, existing subsection 4. If the applicant's average daily production is not more than 50,000 BTU equivalent barrels, that's the large producer exception, that the majors can't get cash for their credits. They have to roll their credits forward and use them against future liability. That's where that power comes from. What we're doing is adding a couple of other restrictions. New subsection 5 says if the revenue from their overall oil and gas business worldwide during the previous calendar year was greater than $10 billion, then they're not eligible to get cash for their credits. If they're a large enough company that's no doubt active in many areas other than Alaska, they would have to take their credit certificates and hold them on their books until the future date when they had a tax liability and use them to offset their taxes. That's So these are companies that are considered comparable in size to our major producers, who, like our major producers, would not be able to get cash for their credits anymore, but instead save them until they had a tax liability. The second restriction, to which there's been a fair amount of public testimony and a lot of the modeling reflected that I showed the committee yesterday, new subsection 6 establishes the $25 million per company per year limit on credit repurchases. And that's, simply put, that's just the cap on how much cash money the state would pay every year to each company, regardless of how much they had in possession in tax certificates, and the rest they would either sell to a third party or, of course, carry forward and use in the next year. And just because of it, elsewhere I mentioned the 10-year sunset. Obviously, there's a first-in, first-out provision that the older credits would be able to be used up first so as not to get sunset, and then the new ones that came in later would keep the clock rolling further into the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that's come up in conversation here is the idea of, additional restrictions on who's eligible for the credits and perhaps, you know, making it phased to final investment decision or something like that. Is this the section of this bill that you think something like that would sort of fit into? Is that, could you see this being the appropriate place, like thinking of it like another restriction, like these restrictions that are being added in here, or does that seem outside of what this section accomplishes?
Through the chair, Representative Tom, to a certain extent we're talking about the other half of the equation of possible restrictions on who can earn a credit tied to current status of having a plan of development or some sort of, we discussed internally, and it didn't survive into the bill, some sort of pre-approval process. The Department of Revenue, you apply and get your project approved before you can earn a credit. That would be on the earning the certificate half. Mm-hmm. The changes made by Section 26 are relatively silent on who's earning the credit. Mm-hmm. They're relevant to the idea of once you have the credit, how do you get cash for it? So I think the two are important factors in a broader reform effort, potentially, but they're sort of opposite sides of the same coin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 11, the unpaid delinquent taxes, I'm just wondering whether the industry and AOGA pushed back pretty hard on this. I'm just wondering whether this is a solution in search of a problem, or if this is happening a lot. In other words, I assume if royalty is due on the 1st of January or the 31st of March, it gets paid. So I'm just wondering, what am I dealing with here exactly?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, this was not something that was a historic problem. We are witnessing it in the environment of bankruptcies in the industry, frankly, where if a company is having severe cash flow problems and potentially heading towards bankruptcy, they might not make that royalty payment or that annual lease payment, or they might have a fine that they're not paying. But yet they might, just from the timing of things, have the expectation of receiving a tax credit payment from the state. Should they receive that payment in whole, it's up to the company's discretion, or if they're in bankruptcy, the court's discretion as to where that money might go, and it might never make it back to their obligations to the state. Generally, there'll be a secured creditor or someone will be in position in front of us. What the chain, and there's several interlinked provisions in the bill that speak to this outstanding liability to the state. The intent is to make sure that the state is made whole before the credit leaves the state system and is paid to the company. There was some pushback that this could be interpreted too broadly, that we could be, if someone's in a legitimate protest or a legitimate appeals process against a tax assessment, that might be used to hold back a credit certificate. That's a point we'd certainly be prepared to talk about and consider. That's not why we wrote this. We wrote this not for the reputable companies that are continuing to go about their business and paying everything that they owe, but for those who are more at the margins, to protect the state's interest.
Hello?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I mean, is there some quick appeasement that could be offered where there's a statutory section that talks about legitimately disputed royalty or tax or something like that?
through the chair, Representative Josephson, the language that's amended throughout the bill takes the sections that say outstanding liability to the state for unpaid delinquent taxes, which is a pretty well understood concept, and gets rid of the words for unpaid taxes. So it leaves these words, outstanding liability to the state. And then later in the bill, you'll see in section 39, which is on the bottom of page 27 of the bill, it adds a new definition of outstanding liability to the state. That's for the definition section inside the broader revenue statutes.
I recall now.
Right. So what you're speaking to would require some sort of tightening or limitation on that definition. That's really where the fix is, if there is, in fact, a need for a fix or a need for some additional certainty that this provision wouldn't be overused.
I recall our discussing that section there. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
What was that definition?
It's on the bottom of page 27 through the chair, Representative Johnson, section 39 of the bill.
Thank you.
And I'll read it. An outstanding liability to the state means an amount of tax, interest, penalty, fee, rental, royalty, or other charge for which the state has issued a demand for payment that has not been paid when due and, if contested, has not been finally resolved against the state. So this would be interpreted, or could be interpreted as I read it, to include a regular tax assessment that might be in the appeals process. And if the intent of the committee was to not include that sort of thing, that's the portion of the sentence that you would look to amend, in my opinion.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But for purposes of Department of Revenue, if it was currently in an appeals process, would you consider it an unpaid liability, or wouldn't it be considered in an appeal status?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, the decision would be made by the appeals group who looked to these things. They would interpret it, but the plain reading of this to me is a demand for payment which has not been paid and is being contested. That almost perfectly defines what our tax assessment process looks like. Say at the end of an audit, we'll say to company X, you owe us $5 million, and they'll say, no, we don't, we're right, and then it goes to appeals. That's a demand for payment which has not been paid and is being contested. Mm-hmm. So as I read that appeals process would fall under this expanded definition.
Representative here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can this new proposed definition, is it only for Title 43 or is it much broader than that?
Through the chair, Representative Heron, it under current law, any tax owed under Title 43 can already be used to offset the credit. That's what it says for unpaid delinquent taxes under this section. That refers to all of Title 43. By getting rid of that language for unpaid delinquent taxes, we're broadening it to all chapters. And the main chapter, frankly, is 38, right? That's where the royalties and DNRs type mm-hmm. payments come in.
Just wanted it on the record, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
No, I'm good. Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chairman, I'm now on section 27. Section 27, in some ways, an extra section of section 26. It was just the decision was made to give it its own section. It's yet one more restriction on the ability to repurchase credit, so it's new language, 028 sub J. And it scales the buyback of a credit certificate to the Alaska Hire, to the Alaska Hire restriction that's been talked about some, section 27. So it says the percentage of the certificate purchased by the department may not exceed the percentage of the applicant's workforce in the state. The workforce includes resident workers both by the company and the company's contractors. And then the portion that was not paid back would then have to be carried forward and used against a tax liability. So again, if we have a 70% Alaska Hire company with a $10 million certificate, we would give them $7 million, meaning 70% of the certificate, and then the other $3 million would have to be carried forward and used against future taxes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This, just because, you know, in previous legislation we've talked about Alaska Hire provisions and tried to, you know, put strong languages, so support the concept. I'm just wondering, in a circumstance where there may be a skilled worker needed for their technical expertise, if that individual is not available in the Alaska workforce, how does the company address that? Do they have an opportunity to, you know, to prove that this percentage of employees was not Alaska hire because we didn't have anybody?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, there is no such waiver provision in the bill as it's written. It sounds like it would be technically complicated to do it, but it certainly could be written. In practical terms, the company you're describing might have owned 95% Alaska hire or less if they had to bring up a team of special projects type experts from outside, no question. That is a consideration. The reality is, hopefully those numbers won't get to the number where it's a severe burden on the payback. That if people limited their out-of-state hiring to where they absolutely have to, hopefully that they'd be getting 90% or more on their money. And once again, we're not taking the money from anyone. That money remains in the certificate and gets rolled forward and used against tax liability. So that's where we're hoping we win the inevitable constitutional challenge to this one. We're not taking cash out of anybody's pocket. We're just changing the way in which we're giving it to them.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's just a concern of whether there'd be a challenge to this provision and trying to understand it a little bit better. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious, on this, it says the department can't purchase it. Does that, it's still a transferable credit. So does that mean if they sell the credit that they have to another company that had a tax liability, it could still be applied against tax liability, or is that correct?
Through Chair Representative Seaton, that is an excellent question. My expectation is that it would be sellable, that the buyer would be able to cash it in, but I think I might want to defer to counsel on this one as well.
You state your name for the record.
For the record, Mary Hunter-Gramling, Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Law, Representative Seaton through the chair. Yes, it's my understanding that any credit not purchased by the state under this provision would still be a transferable tax credit certificate. And in that way, perhaps, you know, by not purchasing 100% of the credit, the state might be actually helping the market along for the market for these certificates. And so that is a distinguishing factor of this provision compared to other tax credit limitations that maybe have tried to look higher in the past, is that here the state, the repurchase of credits is not integral to the calculation of the tax. I mean, they earn the credit amount. And so really this provision is limiting how the state invests its money. And so that's, I think, one of the important distinctions here, is that the credit certificate is still available, as Mr. Alper said, and that you know, it would be available for future use if they had a tax liability, and if they could sell the remaining portion to another company with a tax liability, then that producer could apply it against their tax liability. Transferable tax credits, if they are sold, can only be used against tax liability. They can't be, the person that buys it can't then ask the state to purchase it.
Representative Josephson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The last comment may have sort of gone a long way to answer it. Through the chair, is that true for all transferable credits? They must be used against liability in every instance in our statutes? Just so I can sort of bank that in my mind and know that that's true.
So the transferable tax credit certificates, I'm aware of, in the production tax, I'm not sure about film tax credits because they were purchasable by the state as well, but production tax credits, the transferable ones, they can either be used against tax liability by a company that buys them, mm-hmm. or by the company that earned them. And if the company earned them, doesn't transfer them to another producer, and doesn't have tax liability, then that's when they're applying to the state for repurchase.
Okay. Just
follow up.
Just to be clear, could the transferee, I guess, the recipient of the sold credit, they would not be obligated to do local hire, correct?
No, because they aren't even eligible for repurchase by the state in the first instance. They could only use it against their tax liability.
Once it's
purchased?
Once it's, if a person purchases a credit from another producer under existing law, they can't then apply to the state to repurchase that credit. They have to use it against their tax liability. So that would be unchanged.
And if I may.
One up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you can obviously, that they could sell off part of a credit, right?
That is correct.
All right. So they could undermine this entire endeavor, couldn't they? By saying, well, all we can do is 85%, we'll just sell the other 15. We'll collect 90 cents on the dollar, and we don't have to do this local market. Couldn't they?
Well, they could still, the credit still has value. It's just whether or not the state would be repurchasing it. And so when the state repurchases a credit, that's when the local hire provision would kick in.
Representative Seaton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've always had a really problematic relationship in trying to promote local hire. And although it seems a little complex, it seems like this is probably the first legal way in which we've seen it says this, the state is going to take out of the treasury and pay on the percentage of local hire. But it doesn't take away the tax credits. They're still available to them to sell to someone else that does have a tax liability. And so, I mean, I've been around here a long time, and we've tried it in PLAs and all kinds of things to try and get local hire. And it seems like on this repurchase of tax credits directly from the Treasury, maybe the first one that actually seems to be workable. And not deprive someone of the ability to do what we originally had, all transferable tax credits had to be used, they weren't purchased by the state, they were all used against tax liability. And so I'm interested to hear some more comments from industry, it can be off the record or something, but I think that this, although it seems a little interesting, should I say, it may be our first opportunity to actually influence greater local hire. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Proceed. Our Representative Tallarico.
I think we got all wrapped around the axle with this in the 70s when we were building the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Mm-hmm. And I see these tax credits being connected to just doing the business of the oil industry, which is the same thing we were doing when we built the pipeline. And I remember we knew we were as right as rain until we got to the Supreme Court, and they said, no, you're not. So I have some huge questions about putting any type of Alaska hire preferences in there just because of the legal challenges, I think, that aren't intended here, but I think are probably glaringly obvious to me that might be a major issue. That just as a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we've covered Alaska Hire as much as we could. I believe the co-chair is right. It is inevitably going to be challenged. The decision before the body is: do we want to fight that fight right now? Mm-hmm. And to clarify one thing that Ms. Gramling said, just to make sure that everyone understood it, although anyone can get cash for the credits they earn unless they're those three major producers or the new restrictions we're adding, if you buy a tax credit, those can only be used to offset tax liability. A bought credit cannot be cashed in.
For the record, Commissioner Hawkeye has joined us.
Mr. Chairman, we're now on section number 28. And as I wrote in the sectional, sections 28, 29, and 30 are all conforming. I mentioned in an earlier section, by repealing the qualified capital expenditure credit in 023A and in some places the well-used expenditure credit in 023L, we just need to have conforming language. Other sections that refer to those credits or to those sections need to be modified slightly to get rid of those A's and L's so there isn't a stray language in statute. The section 28 refers to the provisions for being able to assign a tax credit to a third party, a power that was added to statute about 3 years ago. enables the producers to that we the state, the Department of Revenue, are paying the money directly back to banks in certain circumstances. Section 29 refers to the annual statement, the tax return that everyone has to pay in March based on the previous calendar year, clarifying language in there to say that there is no longer going to be a qualified capital expenditure credit, or in some of these cases, what you see is, and the attorneys don't like this, and they're cleaning it up elsewhere in the statute. I've seen another legislation this session, but they don't want to embed the definition inside a substantive piece of legislation. If we needed to define a term, it should be sitting out in a definition section. And right now, within 023A, within the qualified capital expenditure credit section of statute, there exists an existing definition for what a qualified capital expenditure is. So when we are repealing 023A, when we're repealing the credit, we're also repealing the definition of what's a qualified capital expenditure. However, there's value to having a definition of qualified capital expenditure. We need one for other purposes, and therefore Section 38, later in the bill, is adding a definition of qualified capital expenditure. It's not a new definition. It's the same definition, syntactically, as what we have currently in 023A. We're just moving it out into the general definition section inside the production tax statutes. And what you're seeing in Section 29 is a repointing of this term qualified capital expenditures to the new definition rather than to the old definition, which is being repealed. I hope that made sense. It sounded more or less clear coming out of my mouth. but sections 29 and 30 are conforming in that sense. Section 31 was a section that was substantive, that we defined and did some examples and modeling for in the previous presentation. That's the section that says the gross value at the point of production may not be less than zero. That is in the section that's really about tariffs and allowable deductions for transportation to lead to this thing called gross value at the point of production. Gross value at the point of production is really wellhead value. It's the value of the oil or gas minus what it costs to get it to the point of sale. Therefore, it's the value back at the point at which it was produced. The point of production for oil is defined as basically pump station one at the input to the pipeline in the North Slope. So what we're saying is the gross value can't be less than zero, and we made the specific example of a very high tariff field or a field which is very remote or has, for whatever reason, a higher tariff than the value of the oil itself. We considered the possibility that in a period of extended low prices, Point Thompson could plausibly have a wellhead value of less than zero, and this would say, no, you've got to round up to zero at the field level, so you can't use that negative number to offset positive values elsewhere on the North Slope for taxation purposes. That's what Section 31 does. Section 32, meanwhile, is for those members who were around during the ACES debates in 2007, you may recall there was a provision of the ACES tax called the standard deduction. Now, the standard deduction was a limitation on lease expenditure inflation. More or less, we put a cap on how much they can charge for operating expenditures. Based on what they had charged the previous year, it created a little bit of certainty because of some anxiety within at least a critical mass of the body at the time that there would be unchecked inflation and deductible lease expenditures that might erode whatever benefits we were getting from a switch to a net profits tax. So this provision called the standard deduction passed by a single vote as an amendment in both bodies and was a provision of law, and it did create certain restrictions on deductible lease expenditures with a built-in three-year sunset. That's a lot of backstory, I apologize, but all of that is old law that is no longer in effect. Beginning with 2010, there have been no limitations on deductibility. However, those sections still survive in the statute. They are being repealed. We're trying to repeal a bunch of old statute that's no longer needed in the repealer section, and Section 32 conforms with that. It references, it gets rid of a sentence that says, except as provided in J and K of this section, and then continues on with the rest of the substantive language. In other words, we're talking about allowable lease expenditures, and we no longer need to correct for this new limitation, which is now an old limitation, and we can now ignore it and safely delete it. So it's conforming to that change. Continuing, Section 33, as well as Section 36, all the way through 36,
is much the same as 28 through 30. We're conforming to the elimination of the qualified capital expenditure credit, or in most cases more precisely, we're conforming to the moving of the definition of qualified capital expenditure from where it used to live inside the credit itself and to the new definition section, which we're adding in section 38 of the bill. So a classic example, if those members that have the bill in front of them, if you look at section 24 of the bill, these are, page 24 of the bill, subsection 18 on line 11. What this is a long chapter here. These are the restrictions on, existing restrictions on deductions, things that cannot, that are not considered allowable deductions for purposes of taxation. And in subsection 18, we're talking about what's known in the industry as the 30-cent haircut provision that says we don't get to count the first 30 cents per barrel of capital expenditures because it in some ways is a proxy for routine maintenance. But it says that portion of expenditures that would otherwise be qualified capital expenditures as defined in 4355023. And we're deleting the words as defined in 4355023 because the definition has been moved. It's no longer in that location. So this is the sort of conforming changes that you're seeing in sections 33 through 36. It does not in any way change the substantive purpose of the underlying bill and the law as it's being implemented. It just recorrects to the idea that qualified capital expenditures themselves are being defined in a different part of law. And that should move us all the way to section 37, if there aren't any questions on this group. Section 37 was the one that I modeled in talking about the municipal utility who has their own gas and what happens if they're selling a small portion of that gas to a third party. This is, in some ways, an inadvertent language in existing law that says if they sell 1% of their gas and have a relatively small amount of revenue from that, they could, as interpreted, offset all of their costs against the small amount of their revenue and create what could potentially be very large operating losses, much larger than, you know, for companies that might actually be profitable, or in the case of a municipal utility, a break-even non-profit. So they're selling their products at a regulated rate, trying to break even, but they're also making a little bit of money selling their surplus production and then earning potentially large operating loss credits from the state of Alaska. Section 37 corrects that. So it says where current law says a municipal entity subject to taxation is eligible for all tax credits under this chapter, we're now saying proportionate to its production that's taxable. So if only 2% of your production is taxable, you get 2% of your credits. If 95% of your production for some reason is taxable, you get 95% of your production. But just ensuring that you don't get credits that are out of scale with the amount of your production that you're actually selling, because once again, only the production that they sell is what's subject to the tax. The production they don't sell because they burn it themselves in their own turbines is not taxable. The next couple of sections have already been largely discussed because they're the other half of the conforming language. Section 38 is the new definition of qualified capital expenditure. It's a relatively lengthy definition. It refers back to the IRS code because really when you're talking about capital in the federal tax code, you're talking about depreciable. It's treated for tax purposes different than an operating expense because they take its cost over multiple years. We don't use that type of tax treatment. We don't depreciate inside the production tax. We do, however, piggyback on those IRS definitions to be able to define what we mean when we say a capital expenditure. And that's what this language is. It's not new language. It looks new because it's in a new section. It's actually copied almost word for word from another definition that's in another portion of the law that's being repealed because of another change made by this bill. Furthermore, Section 39 is a new definition of outstanding liability to the state. This was relevant to that the ability to hold back credits if the company owes a royalty or other payment to the state. Although those conforming changes that were made in multiple other portions of the bill are conformed with here through this new definition, what exactly is an outstanding liability to the state? And as the committee discussed, there might be a desire to narrow that somewhat
so that a legitimate in-process appeal wouldn't fall within the definition, and that is up to the will of the chair, of course.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on Section 38, so because that QC credit is going away, is that the definition, what will limit what a company can claim? Are there capital expenditures for purposes of, you know, transportation costs, CapEx, OpEx? Or where will that definition be applied?
Through the chair, Representative Todd, there are multiple other places in statute that refer to qualified capital expenditures for other than credit purposes. Generally, those are referenced in the conforming statute where it says operating and capital expenditures. Then you have to refer to those definitions. There's not much of a substantive cash definition between the two anymore because there is no qualified capital expenditure credit.
Okay.
And one exception would be the reference that I made on page 24 of the bill, the 30-cent haircut provision that says for the first 30 cents per barrel of your capital expenditures are not deductible under current law. And that was something that got added as part of the PPT negotiations back in 2006.
And Mr. Chairman,
Arnold?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so this particular, you know, QCE goes away, but this particular definition for purposes of this bill would be applied to that section and limit what can be considered for that, for the cost that 30 cents is applied to.
Correct. To the chair, Representative Tarr, that for any place in statute where qualified capital expenditures, where the term is used, it would now be defined by this new definition in Section 38. The definition is no different. Once again, just the location is. And the only place that I can think of where it would have a dollar value impact with the repeal of the QCE credit would be this 30-cent haircut section. There may be others, but I can't think of them off the top of my head.
Okay. Thank you.
Section 40, Mr. Chairman, is a long repealer section, and you know some of this is cleanup language. I referred in other testimony to some of the old applicability language that comes from Senate Bill 21 that said, you know, Part A refers to oil produced before 2014, and Part B refers to oil produced after. You know, now that we're after, we don't need the old language that refers to the before anymore. So a few of these fall into those categories. What you're also seeing, if you look at the actual language in Section 40, which is on the bottom of page 27 of the bill, I could walk through those. I could probably name most of them if I had to, what these sections being referred to that are being repealed. The whole suite there on the first line in Title 38 and in Title 41, those refer to the older DNR exploration credit that hasn't been used in many decades that we're looking to repeal proactively, as we're also allowing the Department of Revenue's exploration credits to sunset. Those are they no longer have any value. They're not being used. There aren't regulations written to implement them. So we're simply looking to repeal them. The 4320053J4, I believe that's applicability language that's related to the refinery tax credit, but I can't off the top of my head remember what that does. I'm going to bring Ms. Gramling up to walk us through that one. She's a 4320053J4.
For the record, Mary Hunter Gramling, Assistant Attorney General. Through the chair, Alaska Statute 4320053J4 repeals the definition of unpaid delinquent tax, which is no longer necessary because in the bill we've opted to broaden that requirement to outstanding liability to the state.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, so repealing 011M, that refers, I believe, to the ability to use credits over 2 years in certain circumstances. I'm going to well, let's let Ms. Gramling just walk through Section 40 without me, and I'm not going to pretend.
For the record again, Mary Hunter Gramling. So, Alaska Statute 4355-011-M, I believe that is a now out-of-date tax treatment for Cook Inlet. It's just no longer applicable, I believe, since 2011 or 2010. So that's, again, just deleting law that's no longer applicable.
The next two I can speak to, 020 A sub 1 and A sub 2. That is, 020 in general is the monthly installment payment section. So we're talking about how to do that calculation prior to 2014, and then before the changes in Senate Bill 21 took effect. So we're repealing language that refers to older production that's no longer relevant. I knew that one. 023A and then 023L are the credits themselves. Those are the most important in many ways, the most essential to the bill itself. Repealers, 023A is the qualified capital expenditure credit. 023L is the well-use expenditure credit south of 68 degrees latitude. 023N and O, I'm going to pass the buck again.
For the record, this is Mary Hunter Gramling again. AS 4335023N is a conforming repeal to the repeal in Section L of the well lease expenditure credit. That's a kind of companion section there. And then the repeal of AS 430230, that is the actual definition of qualified capital expenditure. And again, that's a definition that we still need in existing law. And so instead of just leaving Section O when qualified capital expenditure is no longer referenced in 023 anymore, we're now moving it to the definition section in the chapter generally. But the actual language in that definition is unchanged. The subsections have changed a little bit due to drafting requirements, but the substance of the definition is unchanged. You want me to keep going? The next repealer is in 4355028I, and I believe that again is a definition related to the repeal of the QCE credit. It says in this section, qualified capital expenditure has the meaning given in AS 43023. So again, that just definition is no longer needed since we've taken it out of Section 023 and then moved it to the general definition section. I believe the same thing is with the repeal in 4355075D1, that again is just a definition change. And then with the repeal of AS 4355165J and K, as Mr. Alper already testified, that those are the standard deduction, and that's just language that's no longer applicable.
Mr. Chairman, we're hoping to make the next year's statute books a few pages thinner, save a tree here and there. Section 43, meanwhile, is the applicability section. This is, as we make these changes, we want to make sure that regardless of the effective date, the things that already are in existence can continue to be in existence. So, for example, we're only making the changes applicable to production after the effective date. So if you do the work before the effective date, even if you come in and apply for the credit after the effective date, you still earned it because you did it before the effective date. That's more or less the primary change made by Section 41. It just clarifies that that the effective date has to do with the work and not with the application. It also, in the event of the 10-year sunset, 10 years from what, and it says, for the purpose of determining the last calendar year a credit can be used, it says, if it was something that existed, if there are existing credit certificates, we're making them start their clock at the effective date of the bill, whereas new credit certificates get 10 years from when they're issued.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Joseph.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Upton, when you talked about getting credit for the work, I'm thinking of the working group's December 1st report, which has a recommendation that there be some sort of lag time. It's not really spelled out well, but basically that the way I think of it is that the rug not be pulled out. When you say the work, not having spent a lot of time in oil fields, I'm trying to think what that means. I mean, What do you mean by that? What if you're halfway done with the project? Can you finish the other half if that's the work?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, let's use, for example, the repeal of the qualified capital expenditure credit, which we are supposing be sunset on July 1st of this year. The company might be in the midst of a project, and they would be able to define and say, this is the money that we spent, this is the work we did before July 1st, and it will qualify, the other work might not. You know, what we're trying to protect in Section 41 is that many of these producers don't actually apply for the credit immediately, that they might keep all their paperwork and wait till they finish their year's books and come in March of 2017 to pay and claim that operating loss credit and just file their taxes in general for that year. Even though they're not applying for that credit, so long as that they're showing that the work was done, that the activities that are earning the capital credit in this case were done before the effective date, they would still qualify.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The sections 42 and 43 are transition language. You see this in a lot of bills. Basically, as we're working towards getting the bill implemented, we at Department of Revenue, Department of Natural Resources as well, are empowered to draft regulations to clarify and implement the changes made by this bill. And oftentimes the regulation process, especially on a complicated piece of legislation, might take a while, could take up to a year. Should those regulations come into being some months later, they could be made retroactive to the effective date of the bill so that we don't have any gaps in coverage or unclarity as far as what the law is during the period of transition. And then sections 44 and 45 are the effective dates. This one has been discussed. I know the industry testimony brought substantial attention to section 44. That's the retroactive applicability of section 17 of the bill. Specifically, that's the only retroactive section. I'm going to quickly page back in my own bill to section 17. That is the limitation on being able to use certain credits to go below the floor. So we're talking about the hardening of the floor, an operating loss, the gross value reduction for the current year in which we're in, going back to last month to January. Well, it's March now. Going back to January, we're going to want the companies to have been paying the minimum tax for all of calendar year 2016. That's the main change. The other change in section 17C has to do with that migrating of credits from month to month that was modeled and explained at some length in an earlier hearing. That one likely will not be relevant for this current calendar year simply because we're not expecting the price of oil to go up above that $80 level, where there's going to be months at the minimum tax and months that are above the minimum tax. Should that happen during this year, then the retroactive application of Section 17 would limit the ability of those credits to be migrated from, say, now. In January, February, you're getting companies earning $8 a barrel credits that are unusable. Should the price of oil spike to $120 this fall, those unused credits from now, per current law, would be used to offset taxes on oil produced in November and December. If Section 17C is made retroactive, that would not be the case.
Representative Hume.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ken, I listened to what you just said, and I guess wouldn't it be just as well is that if we had Section 44, Section 46, January 1, 2017?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, that's certainly a choice of yours and the committee's. To delay the effective date of the bill will affect the dollar value. There are additional dollars worth of credits that will be spent by the state in the intervening period. That's it. There are pros and cons to that. It also would, certainly the case could be made, would provide a certain amount of certainty, or at least transitional certainty for works in progress from the industry. The tax section, Section 44 is a tax section. We're talking about the calculation. The one pushback I've received from my own staff is, please don't make tax sections effective in the middle of a year, because it makes for very complicated calculations. The rest of the bill that talks about the ability to use credits and when an activity might get cut off, that doesn't matter quite so much because you're tying it to a specific activity, to a receipt. That one can take effect in the middle of the year. So if the retroactivity in Section 44 is unpalatable, we would ask that it be moved to January 1st of a different year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Certain of the sections that are more transitional language and about doing the paperwork related to implementing the bill are effective immediately. We're really talking about the transitional language and the one retroactive effective date in Section 44. Section 46 of the bill is the main effective date, and the great bulk of the provisions, the changes made in the bill, we are suggesting take effect on July 1st of this year at the beginning of fiscal year 17, so that all credits earned in the next fiscal year would be under the new regime. And that gets me to the end of the fiscal, of the sectional analysis, and it's a good transition to the fiscal note at the appropriate time if the committee wants to talk about it.
Just one clarifier. Did you say that as to Section 44, if the legislature and this committee didn't adopt the retroactivity, you prefer a January 1st date? Is that what you said? Or were you referring to another section?
No, the chair, Representative Josephson. Section 44 is the retroactivity of Section 17. Okay. Section 7, all of the floor hardening provisions in general, which are sort of codified in Section 17, which discusses how we're not able to use certain things below the floor and the physical mechanics of that calculation below the floor. Because the floor calculation, because the tax calculation is inherently annual, those changes that we're looking to make would make for a very complex tax form if we were to do them mid-year. So if January 1st, 2016 were not desirable, I would ask that it be made at January 1st of a different year.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, as cumbersome as it would be, there's tens of millions of dollars at issue, aren't there?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, if we're talking about the ability to use an operating loss credit to go below the minimum tax, although my fear is that it would take either a lot of conforming language, because really you're talking about and what is inherently an annual tax calculation at the minimum tax right now. Like the way that it is currently written and currently described is an annual calculation. So let's just say for the sake of argument that the hardening of the floor would occur on July 1st, we would have to somehow calculate what is the so-called minimum tax for the first 6 months of the year, allow it to be offset down to zero, but separate it somehow from the minimum tax obligation for the second 6 months of the year. It could certainly be done. We've had split tax years before. 2007 is the classic example, but it's a heavy lift. Yes, there probably are dollars in it, and we're not going to say no to the money, but it is going to put something of a burden on the staff.
Thank you. Anything else?
Mr. Chairman, when I spoke to your aide earlier, he mentioned that once we were done with the section analysis, the committee might want to look at the fiscal notes. I had them right here on the table a moment ago. I mentioned these earlier, Mr. Chairman. There are two fiscal notes that have been provided by the Department of Revenue. One of them is referred to as the DOR tax one, and the other one's referred to as the OGTCF, which is a fund capitalization description. They're in many ways complementary to each other. They add up to the value of the bill as far as the state's bottom line fiscal picture. I'm going to talk first about the tax provisions, and you can see here that we're estimating that the bill will bring in approximately $100 million in additional revenue for the first 2 years, with that number declining to $50 million beginning in fiscal year 19. Why is that? Really, there are two different components to where we're raising revenue in this bill. One of them is the increase of the minimum tax from 4% to 5%. That is easy to understand. There's a tax rate, you raise it to a different tax rate, there's dollars in that. The other provision is a little bit more complicated and nuanced, and that is the so-called hardening of the floor, the restriction of being able to use credits to go below the minimum tax. The main beneficiary of that $50 million, of that second $50 million in the hardening of the floor,
really is in the operating loss credit, where there are the certain major producers, at least one, who had an operating loss in 2015 and who may have operating losses in 2016. Those companies will be able to use their loss credits to reduce their payments below the minimum tax all the way to zero in the year after they earn those credits. So for the first 2 years, we see this being a condition. But by the time we get to 2 years from now, although by no means do we project the price of oil to be rosy, we do project it to be high enough that the major producers will at least be breaking even or making money, and therefore we don't see any cash value to the state in that particular floor hardening provision. However, we foresee being underneath the minimum tax paradigm for the next 4 or 5 years throughout the term of this fiscal note. So that's why you see the $50 million revenue going out to the end of the fiscal note in FY22, but the second $50 million, the floor hardening, only being a value for the first 2 years, thus the drop-off in the value. The other important provision in this fiscal note is on the cost. We are anticipating a cost to implement the changes in this bill. It's a relatively substantial reprogramming of a lot of different formulas and a lot of different provisions in our revenue online and tax revenue management system. Though we do not yet have a firm estimate in hand from the contractor, we put the number $1.5 million in there as something of a placeholder. We're hoping that should this bill move and before it makes it to the end of its process, we'll be able to put a better and more precise number in there for the cost of implementing these sections.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the four-page analysis or three pages of analysis. Could in the first sentence, it's an attempt to reduce the cost of Alaska's current program of providing rebates, but then it ends the sentence with other advantages for oil and gas companies. What does that mean?
Through the chair, Representative Herring, that's a broad term. We're talking about things that could be used to reduce a tax liability or things that could be used to, I suppose if the first half of the sentence is talking about tax rebates, the second half is talking about lower taxes. So because we're hardening the floor, because we're in some cases increasing the taxes that certain companies would pay, with the advantage that they're receiving that we're cutting back on is the advantage of being able to go below the minimum tax to zero. And by hardening the floor and forcing companies to pay at a higher rate, they would no longer receive that advantage.
Mr. Chairman? Right up. Two more questions, if I could. In the several themes or goals of this legislation, there's one sentence that says strengthen the minimum tax and prevent abuses to the system. Can you identify those abuses?
Chair Representative Herring, could you please help point me to the specific sentence?
Under the
okay.
Strengthen the minimum tax and prevent abuses to the system.
Chair Representative Herring, the term was used really to refer to some of these inadvertent or what we perceive to be inadvertent mechanisms where operating losses could be larger than the actual loss, to where a credit could be claimed for a very high percentage of a loss because of that. We discussed it earlier, the interplay of the GDR and the net operating loss credit. The other obvious example where there's something of an inadvertent loophole in statute is for the municipal utility section, where a company is selling a small amount of oil or a small amount of gas and getting a very large credit based on all their expenditures. There's no pejorative intended in abuse. It's simply that people are able to use the system in a way beyond which it was originally intended.
Okay, so just to make sure here, the last word on page two, that's the loopholes you're referring to?
Through the chair, yes, absolutely.
Mr. Chairman, I'll yield and look for other questions, so I'll yield for now.
Okay. Anybody else?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Alper, it strikes me that there's one enormous carrot in this bill, and that is the governor under law is within his right fully to pay 10% per year indefinitely, albeit at some point retiring the credits. And the administration is signaling that it wants to capitalize these credits to the tune of almost $1 billion, providing stability for both sides and predictability, and in effect signaling we're going to, well, in effect saying we're going to waive this right to veto any more than, for example, $73 million this year. Am I reading that right?
I mean, I'm just trying to speak candidly about it.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, you are right. That's in the second fiscal note, the capitalization of that $900 million. And if the chairman doesn't mind, we can jump around a little bit. The statutory obligation, which is 10 or 15% at very low prices, it's actually 15% of the revenue collected under the production tax system, which per our current forecast is about $73 million, is the number the governor put in his operating budget. That's what we're more or less obligated to buy. Now although the tax credit system is somewhat open-ended, people can earn could earn $10 billion worth of credits potentially. We showed a scenario last year where one project could earn $3 billion in credits in a relatively short period of time. The actual limitation on buying them is tied to this language in 4055028B and C that says 15% of the revenue we collect, $73 million. The governor's intent is to reduce the state's annual spend by a substantial amount to a number that we think is sustainable and affordable. However, we want to do that in such a way that doesn't pull the rug out from anybody, that all of the credits that are earned from last year up through the effective date are made whole. So the intent of the second fiscal note, the fund cap fiscal note, is to provide that number. Although it looks like a particularly precise number, $926,575,000, that is simply the difference between the 15% figure in the operating budget and $1 billion. The intent is to put $1 billion into credit repurchase.
Thank you.
And while we're here, Mr. Chairman, Representative Josephson raised the second fiscal note that's called fund cap. Early in the process, originally all of these numbers were in a single fiscal note. We later, per the advice of the Office of Management and Budget, split it into two, because the fund cap is really a separate appropriation that would be somehow attached to this bill that would move almost $1 billion into the oil and gas tax credit fund. It mentions the 73.425 that's in the governor's request, and then you can see in the later columns the expected reduction in tax credit spend that are tied up in this bill, meaning should this bill pass, how much less we think the state would pay. Now that number is somewhat fungible, because as we get closer to the future, we know a lot more about what companies are spending. And we're basing these numbers on our forecasted credit spending in these future years minus about $50 million. We're assuming we're still going to be paying about $50 million in refunded credits and subtracting the difference. What we will do as we get closer to our spring forecast and we have more information, and as the far-term years become near-term years, is continually refine these numbers, of course.
Representative Harris.
Thank you. Ken, on the fund cap fiscal note, page 2 of 2, down there on the paragraph labeled FY16, it talks about this $200 million credit liability expected at the end of the fiscal year. Of course, this note was written on February 1st. Is that real? Because I thought, Mr. Chairman, I thought that we heard in testimony that the people that testified on this said that it's unlikely that $200 million would ever been called upon. Is that correct, or am I wrong?
The Chair, Representative Herron, there are credits that there are credit applications we have in hand that could bring us closer to that $700 million figure. We've only to date issued about $475 million in credits, and we've bought back everything that's been asked for, which is essentially all of them. There might be one or two in process right now. what we find is, and I've said this else at other times, there's a tremendous front loading in the fiscal year. What happens is the great bulk of the credit applications come in March when they file their taxes, because the great bulk of them are operating loss credits. And then in March, they apply, we tend to issue them about 4 months later in July, and then they're paid out early in the fiscal year. The exception to that is some of the drilling credits in Cook Inlet, the specific credits we're looking to repeal in this bill. Because those don't require an operating loss, they don't require an end-of-year tax true-up to apply for them. So certain companies, based on their own cash flow needs or on their own housekeeping, might apply for their qualified capital expenditure or well lease expenditure credits quarterly. They might come in April and say, this is my first quarter credit, and then come in July and say, this is my second quarter credit. We have not been issuing those credits simply because we've known those were the ones we weren't going to have the money for, and we are choosing to hold them until we get the operating loss credits at the end of the year. So we are, through our own activity, forcing that $200 million to get rolled forward into FY17.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we have the two fiscal notes. The first one reduces spending and capitalizes the fund. The other one simply raises a little bit of extra revenue through the strengthening and the increase in the minimum tax. What we discussed in an earlier hearing, the request was made. I don't know that we'll be able to do it in the next day or so, but certainly should this bill move on, the revised version that makes it to its next committee, we would like to take a more fine-tooth comb to the fiscal note. What we hope to do, and you may recall the fiscal note to House Bill, to Senate Bill 21, the oil and gas tax reform bill of 2013, had a full-page spreadsheet of all the provisions of the bill, lined out about a dozen of them, and each one had its own cost parsed out. I think this bill would benefit from having that level of additional analysis. It's complicated, and there's about 15 or 18 separate provisions of this bill. But we are prepared to do that. Hopefully, for the next committee, we'll have a more complicated and nuanced fiscal note. But order of magnitude, we're comfortable with the numbers we're presenting to you, that this is going to raise, in the short term, about $100 million, then save, in the short term, $400 million, but FY17 is a hard one because of the structure of the fiscal note. The FY18 saved $325 million.
Thank you.
You're
done?
If you're done, I'm done.
All right. Any other further questions or comments? Representative Parr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the second fiscal note, you have the ADA $200 million in there as well. And I just wanted to understand how you saw that sort of functioning within this bill. I mean, what I understand in that separate piece of legislation we'll consider is separate from the credit program, but should become a pot of money that just is available for the loans to do, you know, other work that hasn't previously been part of their portfolio.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, yes, you're correct. The reference to that bill and that $200 million is put in this fiscal note for informational purposes. The fiscal note before you was written at the same time as a similar fund cap fiscal note for House Bill 246, the ADA bill that we put together at Revenue, although ADA themselves will be the primary testifiers on that bill. I believe it's counted in this committee on Thursday. So you will see when that bill comes before you another fund cap fiscal note containing $200 million.
Okay.
Anybody else? Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, it's not a question here, but I did want to recognize that you had circulated several other documents to us, and one of them was Pedro Van Meer's update, and just drawing attention to the, of course, speculation in there, but it's been interesting that of correctness of some of those things, but looking at a $60 for the next two decades price. And so as we go forward and work around this, I hope that we'll look at different analyses of the potential price and what information you've given us in other documents. So I just appreciated getting that. Thank you.
Anybody else? Mr. Chairman, if I could refer to one other document. I saw it on several committee members' desks that we sent over yesterday from Revenue. There's a wide format document, a spreadsheet with a little bit of blue ink on it.
Mm-hmm.
That, per the request of the chair staff, we put that together. That summarizes all of the oil and gas tax credits that are currently in existence in statute, how they work, what statute they come from, what their history is, if they have any built-in sunsets, whether what parts of the state they're useful, and then finally at the bottom, adding some new sections saying how we're proposing to change the different provisions. So it does a pretty good job of taking the oil and gas tax credit system and putting it on a single page. It's a little bit dense and technical. But it's the best we could do if we're going to put it on one piece of paper.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
It's also not matted and framed, I think.
But. Like they said in Back to the Future, Mr. the chair of Representative Josephson, we didn't have time to build it to scale or paint it.
Anybody else? Thank you very much for your presentation. Our next meeting will be on Wednesday, March 10th at 1 p.m. We have scheduled our final invited testimony, including Mr. Thomas Ryan and Mr. Ricard Tennis from ING Inc., their financing company, and Mr. Larry Purcelli from the Kenai Peninsula Borough. Is there any further business for the committee this afternoon? If not, we are adjourned.